Hi, I'm Molly Wood, host of Marketplace Tech, and welcome to a little something we're calling the source code. Basically, every interview that I do goes way longer than the 2.5 minutes you might hear on the radio. We give you a little more in the podcast, but some people or topics are so interesting or controversial that I know people are going to want to hear all of it and skip all of the editing and the music and the graphical user interface of radio and just go straight to, get it, get where I'm going here, the source code. Recently, I spoke to Ajit Pai, the newest commissioner of the FCC, at his office in Washington. We talked about broadband access for all, net neutrality, and his reputation online. So here it is, the Ajit Pai source code. Ajit Pai is the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission. Thank you so much for talking with me today.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
And for hosting us in the office with the big Reese's mug that we've all seen on Twitter.
Indeed, yes. Coffee is one of my mainstays and second cup of the day, so you're in luck.
I know that this is not a policy question, but how do you keep your coffee warm in that giant mug?
So I'm very unusual in that I actually don't mind if coffee is lukewarm or even cold. And so I know that most people find that anathema, but to me at least, it's sort of a process, sort of letting the coffee breathe as you would a good wine and just seeing how it evolves over the course of the day. But I recognize I might be more of an outlier.
You know, it would be worse if you said you microwaved it. That would be unacceptable.
Oh, yeah, no, that's just not me. It's a bunch of milk and a bunch of sugar and then just let the temperature go where it will. So.
All right. Same cup all day long. Okay, let's talk about work.
Sure.
So you've made access to broadband a key focus of your chairmanship. Tell me about that and why it's so important to you.
It's important to me because I think the digital divide is the biggest communications issue facing Americans. So whether you're a low-income urban resident or rural resident, if you don't have internet access and the other advanced technologies that are increasingly important to American life, then it's much harder for you to get a job. It's much harder for you to educate your kids. It's much harder for you to get high-quality healthcare and to take advantage of all the other benefits that technology brings. And so as I was surveying the scene when I came on board, it seemed to me that the FCC was squarely empowered to solve that divide, to give everybody as much as possible an equal opportunity to achieve the American dream in the digital era. And I've seen the benefits of it myself during my travels over the past few months, and I'm convinced that this is an area where the FCC can really make a positive mark for American society.
So how do you hope to accomplish that? There are sort of multiple schools of thought about deployment, you know, public-private partnerships, municipal broadband.
Right.
What do you think is going to work best?
I think there are a lot of different tools in the toolbox. From the FCC perspective, there are a couple that I've focused on. Number one, for instance, we have some federal subsidy programs that we oversee. And over the last couple of months, in a bipartisan way, we've reoriented those programs to delivering subsidies to areas that don't have internet access, for example, where people simply don't have any options at all. The second thing we've done is try to modernize our rules to encourage more deployment. To the extent that there are regulatory barriers standing in the way of a company laying fiber to a low-income town in North Dakota or to a tribal reservation in Arizona, we want to try to address that. And the third thing is by working cooperatively with folks across government and even outside of government. One of the first things I did when I became chairman was to set up a broadband deployment advisory committee. I also outlined a number of proposals for Congress to consider, some of which they've taken up. The Gigabit Opportunity Act, introduced by Senator Capito and co-sponsored by Senator Coons, a Republican and Democrat, is a really powerful measure that stems from a proposal I outlined last September. So using those three tools, federal subsidies, modernized regulations, and working with Congress and interested members of the public, I'm really convinced that we can make this a national priority and address that challenge of the digital divide.
So is that enough, do you think? I mean, there's removing barriers and there's tax incentives, but these are areas of the country where so far, you know, companies have said, look, we can't make that much money.
It's admittedly not easy, and I've seen it for myself. I visited the Rosebud Sioux Reservation in Mission, South Dakota, 83% poverty. I've been to Alaska Native villages above the Arctic Circle where there are literally no roads going into these towns. You have to either take a boat or a plane to get in there. So I recognize there are going to be some challenges. But nonetheless, I think it's incumbent upon federal officials, especially here at the FCC, to do everything they can to address the divide. There may be some folks who we just aren't able to reach, but by God, we're going to do our best to reach them nonetheless.
You've talked a lot about the light touch regulatory approach. What happens, though, if you encounter, I'm thinking of digital redlining or companies who are not building out promised investments like Verizon in New York City? Will the touch get any heavier?
There are two different aspects to the answer to that. Number one is that I have focused on digital redlining as an issue, and we want to make sure that from a regulatory perspective, there is no regulatory barrier to them deploying in those neighborhoods, whether it's
– We should probably define that, I guess. We should probably define what digital redlining is.
Digital redlining is the notion that within a certain geographic area, a company might have a business case for building out in areas A, B, and C, but in area D, they simply say, we're not going to deploy there because we don't see the return on the investment or for whatever reason. From a regulatory perspective, we want to make sure that there are no rules standing in the way of them doing that. So for them to get access to the poles, the utility poles that are critical to attaching infrastructure or the conduit that goes under the ground, from a regulatory perspective, we want to make sure that those barriers are low. Secondly, to the extent that we offer companies federal subsidies for building out in unserved areas, we want to make sure that there's accountability. And that's why in some of those reforms that I mentioned earlier, we have reporting requirements along the way so that if we give a company a certain amount of money, they have to tell us within a certain period of time what they're doing with that money. We also have accountability benchmarks. So, for example, with respect to fixed broadband, the wires that go into your home, so to speak, we said by the end of 2017, you have to build out to 40% of your area. By end of 2018, 20% additional. End of 2019, 20% more. And end of 2020, the final 20%. So that by the time this entire program is done over the next 4 years, we want to make sure that every possible area is built out within that geographic area. Because otherwise, as you pointed out, we're simply accentuating the divide instead of solving it.
Right. So is it all – it sounds like it's all carrot, though. Is there any stick in the toolbox?
Absolutely. I mean, well, we can't punish companies for if to the extent that they don't build out and they don't have federal obligations. But what we do try to do is encourage them as strongly as we can in a variety of different ways. And so if they're violating an FCC rule, certainly we will go after them for doing that. And in the meantime, we're going to try to keep encouraging competition as best we can. Some of these smaller providers, too, are really providing an impetus in the marketplace. I've visited small fiber providers, for example, in Detroit. A couple of months ago, we approved for the first time a satellite company's application. They want to deploy 720 satellites in low Earth orbit, so not all the way out in space, but in low Earth, and they think that would be a really substantial competitor to terrestrials. So it's not just the incumbents. We want some of those new companies, innovative companies, to provide an alternative where they might not have done so before.
Yeah, that was kind of my next question, is to what extent are you focused on competition? Because I know you've really tried to accelerate rollout, but maybe removed some of the requirements that there be overlap.
Exactly. So from my perspective, we're technologically neutral. I could not care less which company it is that wants to deploy. We want all of them to bring their animal spirits, as the economic saying goes, to bear. And so that means making sure
that – Is that an economic saying? Whoa, back up.
The animal spirits of competition, if you unleash them and then sort of they focus on competing in the marketplace as best they can. And so
clearly, I have not been at Marketplace long enough because I have not heard that, and it's awesome.
I might be inventing that for my economics class 20-some years ago. So forgive me if it's more of a colloquial saying. But I think it's a really exciting time in technology, I think, because some of these companies are using – access methods that were considered inconceivable just a few years ago. And so from a fixed wireless perspective, for instance, you simply essentially put up a tower and you beam connectivity to a residence or to a business. A few years ago, that was considered to be relatively low speed, low reliability. But now, because of advances in technology, they're able to provide a pretty comparable internet experience. And so we want to encourage more of that by giving them access to more spectrum, by making it easier for them to site their wireless infrastructure. The satellite companies I talked about, we want to encourage them by giving them approval to deploy these satellites in low Earth orbit. All kinds of other technologies are being thought about too. And so I think it's an exciting time. It's going to take a while to get there, obviously, because you can't simply mandate you can't fiat to the ubiquitous deployment tomorrow. But that's one of the things we want to encourage in the time to come.
What have been the barriers? Because, I think everybody feels like competition is not where it needs to be. And are there really that? I mean, some of the regulations are relatively new, so it's hard to imagine. I don't know. I've been covering this a long time.
Yeah.
And I keep waiting for broadband to arrive. And It's like, what is it really going to take?
It's a great frustration. And part of the problem is that we have a very diverse, geographically diverse country. We have some areas which are very sparsely populated. We have other areas which are lower income. We have some which are both, which is extremely challenging. And so to adapt the technologies to those different areas is really difficult. In a lot of cases, also, you have overlapping jurisdictions. So you have federal, state, and local requirements. And I've heard from one startup, for example, that was looking to lay fiber into Detroit, that in some cases, they had to get access to the utility poles, which they found were owned by the city of Detroit. But the federal government didn't have jurisdiction to urge the city of Detroit to give them access on reasonable terms, within a reasonable time frame and at a reasonable price. That was a major barrier for them getting into the business. In rural areas, too, sometimes if you're deploying, you might have to cross different land that is held by different owners, so that some land might be privately held. Some land, especially out in the West, is federally held. Some 80% of land, and I believe in Nevada and Utah, is federally held. And so you have to get permits from the relevant federal agency. How do you know which federal agency holds it? How do you know which person within that agency is authorized to give approval to deploy infrastructure? How do you know that within a reasonable time frame you're going to get approval because there's no self-imposed deadline? So these are some of the things that we're grappling with and trying to streamline it. And part of the vision of the Broadband Deployment Advisory Committee, which I set up, was to identify any and all possible barriers, I try to set up model codes for states and localities that are interested in deployment so they can take an FCC-approved, off-the-shelf solution, if you will, to encourage greater internet access. But it's a hard challenge to solve, no doubt about it. No one, I think, is satisfied with where we are.
Yeah, it's not just as a report. I'm a consumer too, right? And
yeah.
I still have expensive and sometimes unreliable. And, you know, and my family is all in the middle of the country where they only have – I mean, so
– yeah.
To that question of competition, there are also powerful incumbents with a tendency toward consolidation.
Right.
And it sounds like more of that consolidation could be in our future. What kind of barriers does that put up?
I think it imposes some barriers that we want to address by encouraging more competitive entry. And so that's why, for example, if you're a satellite company and you can deploy a nationwide solution using these hundreds of satellites in low Earth orbit, that's an immediate injection of competition in the marketplace. If you're a fixed wireless provider, I've met with a very interesting fixed wireless startup based in the Northeast, for instance, that is looking to deploy that kind of solution in an urban environment, which would provide an alternative to the wired competitors, just as you would see in the rural areas. That's another kind of competition. So I think the barriers to entry hopefully will become lower in the time to come. We're certainly trying to do that as best we can and to make sure that no incumbent is able to sit on his or her laurels and not try to innovate for the benefit of competition and consumers.
Do you feel like – I feel like there are some on the internet who are worried that you're not the guy – that you would – look out for those incumbents,
right,
maybe more than the low Earth orbit satellite people. Can you tell us now that you're not that guy?
Look, yeah, I grew up in a small town in rural Kansas on a dirt road outside of a town called Parsons. And so I can tell you that growing up in the 70s and 80s, I was keenly aware of what it was like to be on the wrong side of the digital divide. And even now when I talk to my parents, I have them FaceTime with my kids. If the connection goes bad, I know it's going to be on my parents' side because they don't have the same connectivity that we have here in the Washington, D.C. area. And so that's why I've made it a personal mission to close the digital divide, precisely because in some cases, these are populations that might not be profitable for the biggest competitors to serve. These are populations that may be just technically or geographically difficult to serve. But nonetheless, they are Americans too. Every American, I believe, deserves what I call digital opportunity. And it would be very easy to simply regulate from afar and make big pronouncements. We're actually trying to solve these problems, very complex problems, with solutions that are tailored to the task.
One of the things the FCC is doing now, it sounds like, is taking comment on whether mobile broadband access is good enough to replace fixed broadband. Do you feel like that's really a solution, considering that the speed differences are so significant? The minimum requirements for wireless are, less than half.
Yeah. So the law requires us to take a look every year at whether advanced telecommunications capability is being deployed to Americans. And that advanced telecommunications capability, I realize, is a phrase that only people in Washington could savor. But at the end of the day, it means how do Americans connect with the internet? And is that connectivity being deployed in a reasonable manner in any given year? And as we think about it, one of the things that becomes obvious if you walk around any sidewalk here in Washington or I dare say anywhere around the country, you see that mobility is an increasingly important feature of how people access the internet. So the only question we're asking here is, how should we think about mobile? To what extent do people rely on it as a complement to or even substitute for fixed? And if they don't, let us know that too. In terms of fixed and mobile, we recognize there are different technical characteristics, that companies market it in different ways, that consumers think of them in different ways. We want to understand every facet of how people access the internet, because if we don't, then we're simply regulating in the absence of concrete understanding of how the marketplace is today.
What don't people understand about the difference between a plan by the FCC and a period of comment?
Oh, I think so. It's a very arcane administrative process that we're required to undergo. But the nuts and bolts, the nutshell is that we are required, before we adopt a new rule or proposal or order, to ask the public for comments. And so this is under the Administrative Procedure Act, which was adopted about 6.5 decades ago. And the idea was that we wanted agencies to take account of public opinion. And so that's why whenever under any administration, whenever the FCC is considering something, we typically issue what's called a notice of proposed rulemaking. We're saying, you know, we think rule X and Y should be adopted, but not rule Z. Tell us what you think. And the public will then have a period to comment, and then they could tell us, well, you know, we like X, but we actually don't like Y or Z. And then that can help the agency guide its decision making. And so the theory is that by having this public input, not just for reasons of accountability, but in terms of better substantive decisions, agencies are better off involving the public in their deliberations. And that's one of the things I'm proudest that we've done. Typically at the FCC, as you might not know, it used to be for decades the case that we would make a decision and then only after that publish the decision, so the people couldn't see what it was we were actually voting on. And so in my second week in office, we instituted a new process reform that would make public at least 3 weeks before any monthly meeting the actual text on the internet of any proposal or order we are considering voting on. And to me, at least, the response has been tremendous. People might agree or disagree with what we're doing, but at least they can see, okay, in paragraph 6, he's thinking about doing this, or mm-hmm. in paragraph 8, they're proposing to do what this. And so I think it's really helpful for the American public, especially in 2017, to have more insight into what we're doing.
The response has been tremendous. I mean, I would say you're my third FCC chairman interview, and probably the only one that everybody knows by name. You know, I mean, it's sort of like, how did, like you said, it is arcane. Nobody totally understands all the rules.
Yeah.
And yet your like wonky little agency is really getting a ton of attention right now. Not all positive.
Right.
What do you think that's about?
I think it's because technology plays such an important role in American life. And I've seen it for myself when I travel around. I try to get out of Washington whenever I can. And in places like Wardensville, West Virginia, they understand the importance of broadband. At that reservation in Mission, South Dakota, they understand the importance of broadband. I heard the story of a woman who was found dead clutching her cell phone. She tried dialing 911 38 times, but her call never went through because they didn't have wireless coverage. And they know that the FCC is singularly positioned as the agency that can solve that. Yeah, I've met with low-income Hispanic parents in Los Angeles who told me that for our kids to be able to do their homework, they need to have connectivity in school and at home. And so I think obviously the FCC can in some ways fall into that alphabet soup in which a lot of these federal agencies are clustered. But I think one of the reasons why we stand out is that we have a really important mission, and our mission can dramatically change the lives of the American people. And not just in terms of connectivity. I mean, robocalling, for example, is another issue that I've championed. It's one of the biggest consumer issues there is. It's the number one issue that we hear about, and I think of the FTC as well, the Federal Trade Commission. And so we've taken a number of steps over the last several months to do that. And I'm always struck by how many people, every enforcement action we take, every rule change we make, how many people flood my inbox with, you know, thank you for doing that. We need more, because we're getting deluged with calls telling us we've won free trips to such and such, or, you know, I have a solar panel for sale if you'll just press number 2, and all this kind of stuff. And so we also have an important consumer protection mission too, which I think people appreciate.
Let's switch gears a tiny bit. I think we're in this moment. We are obviously in this moment of intense political rhetoric. President Trump said things this week that have alienated him from the business community, which you, I assume, are communicating with a lot as you try to encourage investment and broadband rollout. How How does, if at all, that rhetoric from the president affect your ability to, you know, conduct business within the FCC?
Well, I'm always focused on my job. I have so much to do across the different areas that we regulate in terms of internet access or consumer protection or public safety. And so actually, by and large, the FCC, as an independent agency, we've always been focused on the mission. And thus far, we've been able to do it working with members of Congress and the administration and the public pretty well.
It seems like I try to not live my entire life on Twitter, it seems like you're very...
I've not been as successful as you can tell.
Yeah, I took it off my phone, and it's like the greatest thing I ever did.
Right.
You seem very insulated from the storm. I mean, people are concerned. Like, I think consumers are worried that the FCC's taken a different tone, that there's a really different kind of rhetoric. People are just worried about the future of the internet, right? Setting aside everything else that's going on.
Right.
Do you see that? Do you feel that?
I understand there's some issues that are going to be exceptionally controversial, and that's the way it is under any FCC. But we're going to keep focused on the important missions that we've got here, you know, closing the digital divide, preserving the free and open internet, protecting consumers, promoting public safety. And I think over time, these results will speak for themselves. And I'm confident that some of that controversy will fade into the background.
I have to ask you a little bit about net neutrality, but
okay.
But what I want to ask is, you know, like I said, you're my third FCC commissioner, third time I've talked about this issue. And I think we're starting to see a conversation about whether there should be a legislative solution
right.
to this so that it doesn't sort of ping pong back and forth between FCC commissioners.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Well, a few years ago, after one of the court rulings in 2014, I suggested that, you know, I think Congress would be well positioned to take a hold of this issue and just figure out what the rules of the road are going to be long term. And I think in the past couple of months, we've seen increasingly a desire from all sides of the debate to involve members of Congress. And obviously, if Congress sets the rules in statute, then the FCC, the American public, is duty-bound to follow it. And so we'll see what they do in the time to come.
Do you have any idea what that might look like? Or is that like an even farther off possibility than consensus?
I think it's obviously within Congress's purview. I'm not privy to some of the discussions they're having, but it seems like there is an interest in doing it.
Do you think
it
would be better?
In terms of...
do you think it would be a better long-term solution?
Oh, absolutely. I think that Congress, whenever it speaks, if you look at the Communications Act, it's helpful for Congress to set out that blueprint for the FCC in whatever area it is, because I think then you have some certainty as to what the rules are going to be. And after all, to the extent that Congress reflects the considered judgment of the populace and you know, they're representing the populace, it's important for them, I think, to say what the law is, so to speak. And just to let people know one way or the other, these are the rules.
This is the regulatory framework for...
Yeah, I think it's especially helpful, and particularly in an area like technology, which changes so quickly that sometimes I go back and read random provisions of the Communications Act. I know it's pretty boring, but but it's really amazing to see how some provisions of the Act are... I mean, just they must have been very important in that moment of time, but they've been so quickly outpaced by technological developments. And even here at the FCC, some of our rules are on the books for many, many years, and you just wonder why they were first adopted. I remember when I first came on in 2012 as a commissioner, one of the first things I voted on was the repeal of a regulation first imposed by the Telegraph Division in 1936, requiring the certain – I think it was the hard copy – the maintenance of hard copies of certain money order transfers. And you just wonder, gosh, how did this ever come to be? But you know, now if you say telegraph or even the fax machine, I mean, people look at you as if you're from a different era. So,
is that the potential downside, do you think, of a legislative solution? Is that the understanding might not be there or that the rules might not last?
That's always the trade-off with legislation, is that you're capturing a snapshot of the marketplace in a moment in time. And so that snapshot can be yellowed with age. And so the tension for Congress is always whether to make legislative rules very specific, in which case they might become outmoded, or to be more general and allow more flexibility. But in that case, you might have more room for interpretation and less certainty. And so that's sort of the classic legislative problem that the elected officials will have to sort out.
Okay, so we'll just wrap. I discovered that you and I are a similar age. You're a little older. Just kidding.
Well, you just turned 29, in which case I think
you're right. So you're 31 now. So But you know, I grew up in Montana. You grew up in Kansas at a time when sort of the internet was a little bit nascent. And it, and this kind of arc, this, you know, following this for so long, just got me thinking about how I started using the internet. And I was wondering how that was for you. Like, I was using Pine email.
Oh, yes. And gosh,
I thought Prodigy was the internet. Like, I didn't know what an ISP was. And it just made me curious about how that arc has gone for you.
Oh, it's been incredible for me. I mean, I'm sort of like you, growing up in the 70s and 80s in rural Kansas. I still remember when our family got a satellite dish. And I don't mean the small dish you can put on your – I mean this big 10-foot wide thing that sat in our backyard. And you have to wait for a couple of minutes for it to reposition itself for you to watch a cable channel or satellite channel. Those are the days. But anyway, so I still remember freshman year at Harvard – going into the Science Center, so the big building they have with the big auditoriums for science classes. And the first week of school, this lecturer is saying, okay, we're going to teach you about something called email. And I thought, this is so ridiculous. Like, what's the point of this? And then when I learned about it, I thought, this is the greatest thing ever. I mean, I thought Atari 2600 was sort of the peak of technological innovation. I had now discovered the email and Pine and all these chatting things were much more effective. And part of the reason was in those days I played fantasy baseball with some of my friends from high school. And that year we all obviously dispersed. We were going to different schools and whatnot. And we were wondering, like, is the league going to fall apart? And then using this chat function, we realized, oh, my God, we can actually do this over essentially the internet. And it was just a revelation because I know it sounds ridiculous for people who were, you know, under the age of 40 probably. But in those days, once you moved away, like once you didn't have physical proximity to a person, it was really hard to stay in touch with that person if you weren't an inveterate phone user, which I'm not. And so it really did kind of shrink the distance and build bonds that have really enabled people to, you know, stay in touch. And so certainly now with, you know, FaceTime and Facebook and all the other stuff that people have, it's sort of a given that no matter where you are in the world, you can connect with another person. But I don't know. I sometimes sit back and wonder how on earth within the span of a generation or maybe two generations, how on earth did we manage to connect the world in these ways? It's really an incredible achievement when you think about it. And so, especially if you read history, which I'm sure you guys do, like you read about how, I don't know, John Adams, you know, I think it was the election of 1800, you know, was working feverishly to try to avoid war with France. And he didn't get word that the negotiations were successful until after the election was over. And it's sort of, can you imagine now? I mean, my God, all it would take is like a quick, you know, email or tweet or whatever, and you'd figure out what was going on. So it's really an incredible achievement for human civilization. I hope more Americans in the time to come can appreciate it.
Well, I will say, though, I still believe that email has never gotten better than Pine. Some things have not improved over time. Ajit Pai, Chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks very much. I really enjoyed it.